Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife on the program today. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to welcome back Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Lots of things to talk about, excuse me, today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and maybe your outdoor observations. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, it's great to be back.
You're actually not back as in back in Wisconsin, but you're in Florida, and I'm wondering, how are things there after the recent hurricanes that they had?
Well, there's some interesting things going on here, and since it seems like every other person I bump into down here is either from Wisconsin, Minnesota, or Michigan, I felt our upper Midwest listeners might enjoy a little bit of an update on what's going on here in Florida. I felt like I was part of the bird migration driving down here because it was just a steady stream of northern vehicles. But anyway, the hurricane situation right where I am is where the storms came ashore on the West Coast. And although it's a fairly narrow band, the impact was pretty dramatic. There's still a lot of debris around. Quite a few beaches are closed. Fishing piers are closed. And there's some things just disappeared. As a case in point, there's a party boat moored up the coast about 5 or 6 miles that I like to take the grandkids out on, called the Reef Raider. It's a 55-foot boat, and I've been trying to catch up with whether they're running or fishing or not, and I couldn't reach anybody by phone. And finally, I did get a hold of someone, and I said, "Hey, I keep calling about the Reef Raider. What's going on?" "Well, stop calling, because the bait shop and docks and everything else where the boat operated from are gone, just literally gone." So I was over there the other day, and it's just a sandbar now. The buildings, parking lot, docks, gone.
Wow.
And the boat, a 55-foot boat, Larry, was picked up by the storm surge, taken across a 4-lane highway, and leaned up against a condo building.
Boy.
And it's now back, through the use of a crane, I guess, back on the right side of the road, up on blocks. The keel is ripped off, but the boat is there and otherwise intact. But that's the kind of power and force that was involved. And it's difficult to see, and I can only imagine what some of the homeowners and residents and so forth are going through as they try and put their lives back together. So
yeah.
It looks bad on the news when we're sitting comfortably in a warm house in Wisconsin, yeah. But it's a whole lot worse when you're experiencing it. And now, additionally, in the aftermath, there are some episodes of red tide going on, which I had not experienced, but I did 3 or 4 days ago.
What are they?
Over the coast. Well, it's an algae outbreak that it creates a neurotoxin, and it's deadly to fish and a lot of marine life. But it creates respiratory distress in humans, and I didn't think much of it. I heard it kind of comes and goes with the flow of tide and with wind conditions and so forth. But anyway, the family and I were driving over, and we got about half a mile from the coast, and everybody started kind of, "Hey, what's going on? I'm coughing, and my nose hurts, and I can't breathe." And we actually got to the beach, and this is really problematic. And then we realized and saw some warning signs about the tide, and that's what it was causing, were the promised respiratory distress issues. So we simply cleared out. But the aftermath on a couple of beaches that I like to walk on in the morning are some large piles of dead mullet and a few other fish species that the toxic red tide has killed. So it's bad for beach going, bad for tourism, bad for fish populations, and fortunately, it's intermittent and it will dissipate eventually. But on a more popular note, there, the the bird life has been great. I've been seeing lots of birds on the coast and visiting a little rookery that's nearby where some of the herons and hingas and so forth are nesting right now. So that's kind of fun to watch. And there's an interesting debate going on in the state legislature over the state bird of Florida. You wouldn't think that would be a big deal because it's been the mockingbird for 100 years or something like that. But there's apparently been an ongoing effort to boot the mockingbird and restore what most people consider a kind of a bird that's associated with Florida, that being the flamingo, as the state bird. And their populations are actually finally recovering with restoration work in the Everglades. So there's a faction that would like to see the state bird be the flamingo and the state songbird be the scrub jay, which is indigenous to Florida and a pretty little blue jay-like bird that lives in coastal scrub habitat. And so there's a big effort on that and a few other things going on. And right now everybody's a little uptight with the fact that it's cold down here. Not by Wisconsin standards, to be sure, but when the iguanas start falling out of the trees, then people get excited. So
okay. Well, we've got some positive news back here in Wisconsin. Governor Evers named a new DNR secretary, Karen Hien. The position has been vacant since November of 2023. And how important is this appointment in your mind?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. I think it's important to the functioning of the DNR, which is a very important agency in Wisconsin. It's important to the morale of DNR staff to have a leader, especially a leader who hopefully can take charge and begin to steer the ship. So I'm hoping that the political give and take that's caused problems for appointments to the Natural Resources Board, as well as presumably the approval of this appointment of the secretary, will be put aside for the good of our resources and for the good of the agency and its functioning, and that she will be confirmed and take over. We'll see how that plays out. But it's been a long time since Adam Payne resigned. It's high time we had that solid leadership. And from what I see, I don't know her, but from what I've read of her qualifications, working with NOAA and NGOs like National Audubon and the Department of Interior, she has the administrative experience and natural resources background to take over. So we'll hope for the best.
Yeah, we will. I personally don't see any reason she wouldn't be allowed to serve. Do you see any reason why she wouldn't be allowed to serve?
No, but I'm not sure that the confirmations are necessarily always based on logic and reasons. That's why I said I hope the politics involved can be put aside and just move ahead with the confirmation and get back to business.
Yeah. Well, we had the 2024 elk hunt in central and northern Wisconsin ended in late December, and there were 10 bull elk harvested. From a conservation perspective, would you consider this a successful elk hunt?
Oh, it was a great elk hunt. It was successful in terms of the harvest. As you said, the eight Wisconsin hunters who were chosen from over 25,000 applicants, six of them got bulls in the central zone, which was open for the first time. All four got bulls, I think, on one day early in the season. So that was fantastic. And the tribal quota of four was filled, apparently without too much difficulty. So the four and four and two in the northern zone led to the 10 that you mentioned. So it's just another measuring stick in the success of the restoration of elk to Wisconsin. And even better, I think, as people are thinking about the application procedure coming up here in late April and May for the 2025 hunt. This coming year, there'll be five cow tags available or offered for 25. And that's also a first, much like the opening of the central zone to harvest. So not only is it a great measure of success in terms of the restoration, but it's getting better with each passing year.
We have some new hunting regulation proposals. The Wisconsin Natural Resources Board, of course, which advises the DNR, has started the process of drafting some new fishing and hunting regulation. What is the board considering? Do you have any knowledge on that?
Well, not a lot, except they're talking about on the fishing side, they're talking about more adjustments in panfish regulations. As you know, they've done over the past few years to try and improve the size structure of harvested panfish like bluegills, so they usually lower the bag limit to attempt to improve size structure. But the whole process is just getting underway in preparation for offering these proposals on the spring hearings for the Conservation Congress, which I think will be the first Monday in April, as usual. And then they'll go through the whole procedure of public review and review by the legislature before they might be enacted. What they're specifically thinking about in terms of hunting regulations, I don't know. And I'm not sure they know either, since the whole process is just getting underway.
Yeah. There are hundreds of thousands of dollars available for game bird habitat management projects in the state, and the DNR is accepting applications for funding for, I think it's turkey and pheasant and waterfowl projects until February 14th. So it's coming up. Where does that money come from?
Well, the money comes from the sale of the stamps that are required for people participating in the hunting of all of those species, pheasants, turkeys, and waterfowl. I think most people have heard of the duck stamp, so to speak, because there's a federal analog. The federal duck stamp has been around for almost a century now and has been the mainstay of providing conservation funding for wetlands protection, purchase, restoration, and so on, both in the United States and Canada. So Wisconsin also has its own waterfowl stamp, as well as the pheasant stamp and the turkey stamp. And the money generated by the sale of those stamps is targeted at going right back, so to speak, into the conservation of those species. So it's kind of a self-serving thing. A pheasant hunter, for example, is required to purchase that $10 stamp. But I think with pheasants, a sizable percentage of that is earmarked to go directly to the game farm to produce and stock the pheasants that the people buying the stamps are pursuing. So there's a direct relationship there. It's a user pay situation, and it's worked very well. The balance of the pheasant stamp money and the vast majority of the money for the other stamps, turkeys and waterfowl, goes back into the conservation of those species through land management, protection, and enhancement, with some amount of the Wisconsin money even being targeted for conservation in Canada, where many of our ducks are produced. So it's a great system, and some people view it as, oh, gee, it's just another license or tax that I need to pay. But in this case, there's a direct relationship between buying those stamps and seeing things done on the ground that improve the situation for all those species. So,
and not only those species, but a lot of other species, non-hunting species, are helped by that money from those stamps.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if a wetland is protected from development, drainage, or whatever, then there are all kinds of amphibians, reptiles, birds, and small mammals and whatnot that utilize that wetland, even though it's being protected ostensibly to improve waterfowl habitat. So yeah, it's a good system, and I urge, and there's certainly other people, anybody can buy the stamps, and they're usually pretty. There's an art competition every year to see whose artistic creation is going to be featured on the stamp. And then those are available for sale. And anybody, either for collecting purposes or just to appreciate the artwork or whatnot, can buy them. And anyone who does is contributing to the protection and enhancement of those species in their habitats. So Yep. It's hard to find a flaw in that system.
It is indeed. Scott Craven, our guest, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. You have a wildlife question or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mailer here. Hope you'll join us tomorrow morning for live special coverage of former President Jimmy Carter's state funeral service. Host Steve Inskeep and NPR's political team will bring you the entire service from the National Cathedral and offer some analysis. That's special live coverage here on WPR News and WPR.org starting at 8:30 tomorrow morning. So looking, wanted to let you know about that particular change in our regular programming. Scott with us now. You can join in. Maybe you've got a wildlife question or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. A friend of mine, Scott, is already out fishing. The early inland trout catch and release season opened January 4th. You can only use artificial lures, and you need to immediately release anything you catch. But there are, at least I know, some anglers who always look forward to it.
Well, it's a popular opportunity, and that's really what it's all about, is more opportunity for our state trout fishermen to get out there and enjoy the resource, even though it may seem, wow, do I really want to stand in an ice-cold stream with a foot of snow on the bank? Now, there's no snow right now, but there will be. But again, it does provide some opportunity leading up to the first Saturday in May when the traditional opening day occurs and people are actually allowed to keep a few of the fish. So for those who are interested in it, go for it. Have a good time. I'm quite happy down here fishing for sea trout, which aren't really trout, but look like trout. So, it's open. I think it opened up on the 6th of January, and it runs now up until the traditional opening day. So,
yeah, up through May 2nd.
Go get them.
And one other thing, you may not have seen it, but there was a CWD found in a year-old wild deer in Chippewa County. It's the first positive test in Chippewa County, so it keeps moving northward.
It keeps moving. I did see the press release. I get the DNR press releases on my phone, and I think that was the first time in Chippewa County, although it had been in adjoining counties. Yeah. But one way or the other, it's still expanding. It's the prevalence is increasing where it's been for a long time, and there have been also seen a couple of recent columns that Pat Durkin and others have written about the continuing. I don't even know what to call it anymore, Larry, other than an ongoing disaster, and yet it doesn't seem to be high on the minds of a lot of folks involved in the, you know, amongst our orange-clad army going out in the fall. I don't know how much of a priority it is anymore for a lot of folks, because a lot of deer go untested, and a lot of folks are trying to continue business as usual. But I think the most compelling thing for me were the accounts that Pat Durkin reported from several different hunting groups in the southwestern part of the state, where their reports, and they've tried to maintain their hunting groups and the hunting tradition, they've reported without exception that they don't feel, these are people who are on the land, own the land, manage the land, and hunt the land, and a couple of them said they don't feel that they're seeing 25, 35, less than 50% of the deer they used to see in these landscapes in Iowa County, Richland County, Dane County, and so forth. Certainly, there are still some places with quite a few deer, and we're concerned about that in the metro units and so on. But in terms of the landscape that once supported a very large, perhaps too large deer herd, there are far fewer animals.
Yeah.
And the prevalence rate in the adult animals is extremely high, such that, well, I guess the two things that I would point to. Number one, as you looked at the harvest statistics that came out of the 24 season, which is just finally winding down, the leading counties for harvest, which often were counties like Iowa in years past, are now up in the central forested areas, and the harvests are pale in comparison in counties where CWD has been present for a long time, like Iowa and Dane and so forth. The harvests pale in comparison to what they once were. And it's hard for me to come to any conclusion on that other than that's directly attributable to chronic wasting disease. And yet here we are. We haven't come up with much of a strategy to deal with it. It just continues.
The other
evidence from my point of view is after 52 years of hunting in Iowa County, I finally threw in the towel, and we drove up to Door County where I had an opportunity to hunt on a piece of private land. And it was a long drive, but driving back with my son, we said, hey, you know, that's kind of neat, a little different environment, different forest type, but it was kind of nice to sit there realizing that if you saw a deer, yeah, darn thing was healthy, and yeah, you could actually shoot it and take it home and eat it. And we've been 4 years now since we shot a deer in the south that wasn't positive, and that was becoming a little tiresome. So
yeah. Well, anyway, let's take some calls, and we've got some other issues to deal with. And here's a question from Chris in Madison. Chris, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I live in the Madison area, as you said, and I'm curious. I've been seeing a lot of robins, and I was at Picnic Point down near the UW campus, so near the water, Lake Mendota, and I'm curious what the robins are doing this time of year. I was under the impression that they migrate. So I'm curious if that's the case and what might be happening with the robin population.
Yeah. Well, some do and some don't, I think, Scott.
That's right. I mean, yes, they are a migratory bird, and the vast majority of them do clear out, head south, and then we get to say, oh, the robins are back around the first week in March. But invariably, there are some pockets of robins around the state. In the Madison area, for one, and there are a couple places over in some of the western counties along the river that are notorious for hosting robins all winter long. In Madison, for example, if you really want to see a robin, the best place has always been around the springs in the UW Arboretum, that where the springs feed into Lake Wingra and maintain open water. But it's only been fairly recently that the big lakes have frozen over, and there's not much snow cover. And things were reasonably mild into December, so it doesn't surprise me at all that a few robins have hung on. With it as cold as it is now, and with the lakes finally frozen over and whatnot, I think those stragglers will probably say, well, let's get the heck out of here. And they will leave, except for some of those spots that provide a little bit of habitat that they take advantage of, and then some do hang around. So it seems strange, but it's not unheard of, and they'll likely, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if they're gone now. So.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Question, we'll get you on pretty quickly. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. A couple of emails I wanted to share with you. One was from Mark, who emailed to ask how a teacher, how might a teacher get their students involved in the duck stamp creation process?
Well, that's an interesting one. I guess by creation, I assume he's referring to, you know, creating some art.
Yeah.
That might be considered for the stamp. And that's a process that's open to anyone. And so as a class, I could envision a class project where you may provide the students with a list of waterfowl. And there are some species, First of all, I would talk to the DNR migratory bird specialist or somebody in that office at the DNR home office and get the essentially the straight skinny on how the contest actually works. And that's probably available on the DNR website, too, because I don't think that they would accept the same species a year after it was used. For example, if last year's duck stamp was a wood duck, I don't know what it was, but if it was a wood duck, I don't think they want another wood duck immediately. So there are a relatively few stipulations like that. But beyond that, armed with the guidelines for submission, you know, as a class project, they could create images of virtually any waterfowl species and run it through the process. It kind of interesting. I guess I'd never thought about the fact that usually since the print sales are important to the artists, they're very well done. I mean, generally the contest is won by well-known artists, but maybe they should think about a kids division or a youth contest on the side. Maybe they do. I don't know.
They do. Yeah.
But I think that a duck stamp created by a young person might have some appeal, even though the print situation might not be there. So I guess the powers that be could be approached on that. But certainly any teacher who wants the kids to choose from a list of waterfowl and say, oh, I like this. I think that duck's pretty. I'm going to draw that and create an art rendition of that bird in its natural environment. They could do it, and they could do it repeatedly and have their own internal competition and then send the winner up through the ranks. No problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken, who is driving his semi right now, has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Years ago, in the deer hunting, what they call the holiday season between the Christmas and New Year's holidays, they had, in some of the other seasons also, they had earn a buck. And apparently some politician had a nice buck go by and he hadn't shot a doe yet. And the powers that be passed a law that they can't have earn a buck anymore. It's not the DNR, it's the state politicians. And I hunt in Richland County, and we used to have a lot of fun hunting in that holiday season and taking doe and getting another buck tag and having way more fun then than we did even in the regular season. And if they wanted to control this population so they could do something about CWD, they'd follow the science instead of following the whim of some politician.
Scott, I don't think you're going to find any disagreement.
I couldn't have said it any better than our truck driving caller just stated it. It earn a buck was a very powerful tool for herd management, but it was also, while it was popular with some factions that liked to utilize it to earn extra buck tags and so forth, generally speaking, the politicians who had sway at the time felt that what they were hearing from their constituency was a lot of grumbling that, hey, we don't like to be forced into this. You know, we want to be able to shoot what we want to shoot, and you can't tell me I have to shoot a doe before I get a buck tag. And as a result, as the caller just stated, it was the legislative process that said, down with earn a buck, and we don't want to ever see it again. But it comes up periodically that, boy, if we only had earn a buck again in the toolbox as a way to control some of the herds that are where they're both too large just for general reasons, whether it's crop damage or deer vehicle collisions or whatever else, let alone herd health and CWD, that tool was taken out of the toolbox by the legislature. So for better or for worse, that's the way it is.
Ken, thanks again for calling. Let's go to Fred in Madison next. Hi, Fred.
Good morning, Larry. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
My question to you and to Scott is, I think a number of years ago, the DNR negotiated with farmers around public hunting areas to gain access to their land for hunting after crops were harvested. The problem is, and I hunt basically in Dane and adjoining counties, the problem is the combination of GPS and clean farming has rendered those leased farm fields almost unusable. They don't support any wildlife because there are no weeds, there are no fence rows. They farm right up to the ditch line, so you can barely even walk, you know, along the ditches. It just is very disconcerting. I'm wondering if the DNR has ever considered renegotiating those leases to provide for more space along the fence rows and along the ditches, so that there would be weedy patches and wildlife supporting areas.
Hmm. Scott?
Well, that's an interesting idea. I too hunt in Dane County, and there are certainly some farm fields adjacent to, say, the Brooklyn Wildlife Area, which is a large one just south of my home, where, yeah, the birds are in there during the when the crops are standing, but once they're harvested and then you can gain access, there's as the caller says, not much in there. On the other hand, I think that I'm not sure specifically what the regulations are in terms of crop harvest. Some of the lands that are open regardless of crop status, but hunting in standing corn is not an easy proposition. And even when the corn is harvested on some of the fields that I know are adjacent to Brooklyn, there are still some fence rows and ditches and so forth that are often worth walking. So I'm not sure about whether the renegotiation issue, where clean farming has eliminated virtually any huntable habitat, as opposed to what is accessible throughout the season. But that would be a question for the local wildlife managers with the DNR, and I can't say a whole lot more about it, Larry. I understand the problem, but at least there's some open access there. No crop field is completely devoid of a turnaround corner or a two-track or something. So there's at least a bit of benefit and some open land regardless. So, but that's really a question for the DNR managers in terms of how they handle those lease agreements or gentlemen's agreements, so to speak, with adjoining landowners.
Fred, thank you again. Appreciate it. I want to go back to the caller who asked about a stamp contest for kids. And Tim Isley is a regular guest on the show, emailed to say that the teacher who emailed earlier can get their students into the Junior Duck Stamp Contest. The contest is for kindergarten through 12th grade students. And as Tim says, it's good to compete and get involved. So there you go. And we had a couple of other people call in to reply on that. So it's the Junior Duck Stamp Contest that the teacher could look at.
And I think that's that's a federal issue. I mean, that's I think a junior version of the federal duck stamp.
Yes,
I think.
Yeah.
But I knew Tim would know, and I was hoping he would bail us out on that.
Jay emailed here, the Minnesota DNR has expressed concern that the technology used in ice fishing may work so well that it could be a threat to sensitive fishing populations. Could fishing or maybe hunting technology someday be regulated by the DNR? Jay wants to know.
Well, I think that's an absolute yes. I mean, there's already concern over some fishing technology like forward-facing sonar and so on, where there are tournaments that have have banned the use of such technology during tournaments, and they'll eventually have to, I think personally there'll have to be some consideration of how far you can go with technology before it's a problem. There was just a recent treatment of this topic by the Wildlife Management Institute and the Boone and Crockett Club, which is famous for their promotion of what's referred to as fair chase in hunting and to a certain degree fishing. And the question that was posed was, how far do we go with technological advances before fair chase is no longer really fair chase? And that's a tough nut to crack. No question about that. And it's already, people started to talk about that even in Leopold's day, when he had a quote talking about the inverse relationship between the amount of technology and the quality of the hunting experience. And that was a long time ago. And now it's been repeated with debates over compound bows and archery hunting, with mojo ducks and mojo doves as decoys in some types of bird hunting. And now with the use of drones, use of cell phones, use of forward-facing sonar, use of infrared technology, and now, who knows, with artificial intelligence, I'm frankly, like some other people and like the caller who brought this up, concerned that we're just about, if we haven't already gotten to the tipping point, we're darn close to it, where this is no longer fair chase. And I think the use of some of these technologies will unfortunately push support for non-hunting and non-fishing members of society, but who also vote, push them further and further away from support for some of these things if fair chase is disregarded. I don't know where it's going to happen, Larry, but like a lot of other people, I'm concerned about it. And but it's a tough one, because people gravitate towards things that improve their success rates, and that's understandable. That's human nature. If you if you're sitting in a boat, if you're in one end of the boat and somebody's got their own little portable sonar unit or whatnot, and they're catching fish hand over fist, and you're not, then all of a sudden you become an adopter, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like what happened with deer baiting and so forth. When you heard one of the justifications with deer baiting from people, you'd hear this, well, I don't like it, but I have to do it because everybody around me is doing it. And that's unfortunate.
Rick in Marinette County has a question for you, Scott. Let's go there. Rick, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, I've been I'm 7 years old now, and I've been gross bird hunting since I was about 9 years old, and I've always had a dog to bird hunt with, so I enjoy hunting with a dog. I think that's the best enjoyment I think there ever is, to hunt with a dog, to watch a dog work. But gross hunting has progressively gotten worse. I got a really good dog right now, and I've been going out bird hunting with him. I go out day after day. I don't even see a bird in Marinette County, Forest County, even go out to Forest County. This whole area up here, no more birds, no more grouse. But then that DNR say this because it's got that disease, and I don't believe that really. What I know, because I looked it up online. And I asked other people, asked DNR guys, and they say that almost every 7 years cycle, it loses its cycle every 7 years.
Yeah.
And what happens every 7 years, the owls come from Canada down here, and owls are the number one predator for grouse. For up in this area, we only hunt grouse up here and woodcock. And why can't the DNR, I know it's hard, they say they don't do that because the success rate for planting grouse in this area is unsuccessful. they don't reproduce as often. But why, even if one grouse reproduces one out of 50 that they plant here, at least it's gonna get more grouse in this area.
Scott, what do you think?
Oh boy, that's a complicated issue, Larry, because grouse hunters' success varies within a township, let alone a county or a region of the state. But over time, habitat changes. That's what we saw in southwestern Wisconsin when. And I'm talking 40 or 50 years ago when there were good grouse populations in the southwestern part of the state, were now virtually non-existent. As habitat matured and changed and so on, and the birds simply disappeared. Up north, there are a couple of issues going on. One is the inherent cyclic nature, not the cyclic nature of predator birds, but the cyclic nature of grouse, which is a 10-year fluctuation, so that you go from periodic lows through a 5-year period of rebuilding, and then all of a sudden, gee, there are good grouse numbers again, and then the whole thing starts over again. So it depends a little bit on where you are in the inherent natural cycle of the birds themselves. Part of that cycle is the invasion of raptors and predatory birds, but it's primarily goshawks that are the main predator on grouse rather than owls. But that, again, is a completely natural phenomenon, and there's little or nothing we can do about it except work with it. But the real driving force between grouse populations, whether they're high or low in their population cycle, is the habitat that's available. In terms of logging and mature timber versus younger aspen, and aspen's been declining on the landscape for quite a while, there are all sorts of things interacting here between hunter behavior, predator abundance, the natural cycle of grouse, habitat conditions, and so on, that determine whether somebody's in a good area or whether they're not. And I heard, I've got a cabin in Price County, and I heard some reports from people who had really good grouse hunting this year. And others who did not. And you kind of have to follow the birds and the habitat to find them and pay attention to the cycles and other things that are going on. There's still good grouse hunting to be had, better in some years than others, but some areas that used to be great are not anymore. And unless there are major changes, they're not going to be for a while. So I don't know what more to say about it than that, Larry. It's a complicated interaction of a lot of different things.
Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist from UW Extension. Great to have him along. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Couple of comments, email comments relating to robins. Scott, Michael emailed to say the situation with robins involves more than a few stragglers. On January 4th, in just one of 15 sections of the Sauk City Christmas bird count, Michael counted 703 robins. And 2 weeks earlier, a birder in the same area counted 1,150 robins. Michael's seeing robins elsewhere in large numbers than they've ever seen them in December. And then just to go along with that, Chuck in Vernon County emailed to ask what percentage of robins we're seeing in southern Wisconsin throughout winter are year-round residents and what percentage are from northern areas. We probably don't know, but...
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. There's no way to see a robin and say, oh, that's a resident robin versus that bird's moving through, or that one's headed for Arkansas and that one's headed for Louisiana. We don't know that, but it doesn't surprise me that there were large numbers of robins around. I mean, it was summer-like weather and well into the fall, normal fall, and then it's been a relatively deception that one storm just the week before Christmas. We've not really had much by way of winter weather until this last Arctic blast. So the fact that they were still around doesn't surprise me at all. I was hearing before I left for Florida, I was hearing lots of swans going over and cranes and assorted other things, well into the late fall. So
yep.
That's the way it works.
And back to grouse for a minute. Owen emailed to say they live in northern Wisconsin near Cornucopia and have never seen as many grouse as they've seen this year. This is where the snowy or the great gray owls periodically come. I guess it depends on where you are when it comes to grouse, as you were saying, Scott.
It absolutely does. So I think much the same as deer hunters who are troubled by CWD are trying to branch out to new opportunities. Grouse hunters who have seen an opportunity where the forest they hunt in have matured, changed or whatever, it's time to become a little more flexible and move around a bit, because there are opportunities out there, much like where the fish are in a lake, and you need to go where they are.
Joe in Phelps, Wisconsin has something for us. There, let's go there. Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Professor Craven, question for you.
Okay.
I've been watching. I'm up in Phelps. I've been watching the wolves and their population, and it's been. But have you seen any numbers that with that hunt slash trapping season they had a couple of years ago? It seems like in the last couple of years there's been a little bit of an exponential growth of the wolf population up here. I grouse hunt. I see the tracks, and the last couple of years I've seen way more. Do you think that hunt where they're trying to reduce the numbers actually ended up increasing the numbers because they killed the alphas or the males or the females, and the packs ended up dispersing, and in the long run they actually increased the population instead of decreasing the population?
Well, it's an interesting idea. There are a couple of points to make, I guess. If you go back to the years, I think in 2012, 13, 14, somewhere back in there, where we had 3 years in between federal listings where there was a well-managed hunt, the reductions that those hunts created did depress the wolf population in following years. And then that, with protection restored, they bounced back again. And then with this emergency hunt that happened in 22, I guess it was, where the quota was exceeded rather quickly because of a variety of reasons, there was some immediate depression. But the wolves have certainly bounced back nicely with the restoration of federal protections. But I don't think that was necessarily facilitated by the specific individuals or the number of individuals who were harvested during that rather hasty hunt, in terms of it didn't last very long and it was put on hastily. But the bottom line is wolves are doing very well. People are reporting lots of contacts, lots of tracks, lots of sign, lots of sightings in people's backyards. There have been a couple studies released lately that suggest that wolves aren't as troubled by road density as we once thought they were. Wolves are habituating well to presence of people and so forth. For me, the bottom line is we need to get some of that legislation through that will take them off the federal endangered species list and put management of wolves back in the hands of the DNR. I think the DNR demonstrated back in the days of those managed hunts that they could do that and would do it, and that it had some benefit. And since depredations claims are increasing and wolf sightings and interactions are increasing, it's time to get them off the federal list. And we'll see how it goes.
Scott Craven, our guest today, he'll be with us up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back to talk more with Scott and answer your questions. Stay with us. Got a Wildlife Wednesday on the show today. Larry Mueller here, and my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension retired wildlife ecologist. Great to have him back. And lots of callers online, so I think we'll just go straight to the phones, Scott, and let's talk with Philip in Iron River. Philip, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I just had a question with turkey population in regard to nest predation with grouse and other songbirds. They're very much opportunists, and I wondered how they might affect those populations.
So, yeah. Scott?
I think the answer to that is fairly easy, Larry, although there's a common perception that, gee, turkeys are out there in the landscape. They're big. There's lots of them. They're moving around foraging and whatnot, and they will eat amphibians and a snake and so forth. I don't think there's much, if any, evidence to support the fact that there's a negative effect of turkeys on other nesting birds, especially ground nesting birds like grouse or thrushes or whatnot. So I don't think that's anything we need to worry about.
Let's go to Christy in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A comment and a question. We had a really exciting opening weekend. We were hunting Carrieville FNA in the Lower Chippewa River. And Saturday night around the campfire, my nephew looked at me and said, I saw 50 birds that had red heads. What is that? And he said, it's smaller than a pileated. So I grabbed my sibley. We don't have remote access there. And I deliberately left the redheaded till the end. And when I got to that page, he said, that's it. So on Sunday, I had him drop me off at the island. And I slowly worked my way, leaving the oak savanna to the end of the slow walk. And I heard what I thought was a tree frog. Like, what's a tree frog doing in an oak savanna in November? But then one went up on one of the bur oaks up there. And it was bat-like, but I could see it was almost a dark moon head. And then as I walked closer to where he has his stand, it was more woodland. And I could count like 6 to 8, you know, Sibley calls them a flying checkerboard, the black and white. And for sure I did redhead. And I entered that on eBird. I entered only 6 or 8 that I saw. I didn't enter his 50. And then I was talking with Ann Garrity up here, who's a very experienced birder. And we got thinking maybe they were rounding up for migration. It was about 38, 40 that weekend degrees. And then my second comment, I know you're saying I was biking on the bike trail just south of Sunset from Carrieville, and a bald eagle flew over me, and then immediately a common merganser flew. And the question there is, might that bald trigger the merganser to fly off the water?
Okay, a few things there. Red-headed woodpeckers, a large number seen in Chippewa Falls area by Christy. And then would the merganser, I think it was merganser, have flown away because of the eagle flying? So a couple questions there, Scott.
Well, let's take I missed a lot of that, Larry, because of the connection was somehow it was intermittent, but if a merganser or any other bird on the water, be it a loon or a merganser or whatever, is not going to be happy about an eagle flying over. And loons react very quickly to that. I don't see any reason why the merganser wouldn't have either, and it may have flown off for that reason. It may have flown off for some other reason. I simply don't know. As far as the red-headed woodpeckers are concerned, beautiful bird, easily identified when seen and not seen commonly. I don't think I've ever seen more than a pair together at any one time. So a number of them like that is of some interest. But what to attribute it to, I can't say. I don't know. This is where we need to turn to the audience and say, audience, you birders with a lot of experience, what have you got to say about an unusual concentration of redheaded woodpeckers, and yeah, see what we get.
Been a while since I've seen a redheaded woodpecker, for me anyway.
We watched a pair while we were having lunch on the opening day of deer season out in Grant County. They were working on a snag right by the cabin, and they're beautiful birds, and I enjoyed watching them, but
Like I say, I've never seen a concentration like that, and I can't explain it.
No.
So,
Fern in Granton, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I just have a question about wildlife with how we manage it. And I always think, like, it seems like the animals know how to manage themselves better than we know how to manage them, because we take the healthy deer, ducks, whatever, but wildlife takes the sick because they don't want to work hard for their meal. I mean, the bear, the cougar, the wolves, they will bring down the deer that's, you know, lagging behind the group, and normally they're sick or old, you know, but we passed over them and then take the healthy. And I think maybe that's why diseases are spreading so much through the deer herd now, with the brain disease and stuff. You never, just such odd things. And I thought, it's too bad we can't work together with the wildlife, you know, bring in more, let the wolves, you know, the wolves are good. That's good. They're getting populated, but the cougar and the others, you know, they are the ones that will eat these. Well, they're almost the best veterans for the wildlife. I mean, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, sure. There's no question about it. With predators hunting, anything that's debilitated in any way, injured, sick, slow, old, feeble, whatever, is more vulnerable to being taken. And that does provide something of an ecological service. But the notion that we can utilize that strategy here in Wisconsin to any observable effect is probably not in the cards. The large predators that we once had, be it mountain lions or more bears over a wider distribution or more wolves, simply are no longer sustainable in an environment or on a landscape that's dominated by humans and human pets and human livestock and assorted other things. That's just not going to happen. And even where wolves are present, this debate has come up many times over the years, and the statistics involved with the number of deer we have and the number of wolves we have, even if you just take an argument of 1,000 wolves, for example, all in one area, and how many deer they could or would consume over the course of the year. The literature would suggest, I've seen 17, 20, something like that, deer would sustain a wolf over the course of a year, and then do the math, and it doesn't work out. Plus, that wolves are not necessarily in the same place that large deer herds are. So while in theory that sounds like a good idea, in practical application, it's not conceivably possible anymore in a landscape like Wisconsin's. And even in Western landscapes, Wyoming or Colorado, or take Wyoming, for example, where they've documented herd level impacts on mule deer with chronic wasting disease. In other words, it's having a population effect, but yet there's Wyoming with a complement of natural predators in terms of mountain lions and whatnot, and hasn't seemed to make any difference. So, it's a good thought, a common thought, and a logical thought, but in terms of practical application and implementation in wildlife management over a large area or a large scale, probably not possible.
Fern, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Lee in Green Bay. Lee, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if Scott could comment and fill me in and the listeners. Something about an over-harvest of bear by 400? Did that happen this last year, or am I wrong? I just heard a rumor. Somebody told me. I don't
know. Go ahead, Larry, because I don't have the bear statistics in front of me, but I think it was a very good harvest year.
I do, and I don't have those numbers in front of me either, but I can quickly look them up.
But over-harvest is kind of a... It connotes that something went wrong or it's a negative thing. And over-harvest in the terms of bears would simply mean that the quota that the DNR had established to be taken, what they thought was safe harvest levels, was exceeded, either because of unusually good conditions or the bears were slow to get into hibernation or whatever reason, usually good weather and conditions. more bears than they had expected to be taken were taken, but that doesn't necessarily mean that was a negative thing for the population. Overall, bears are doing pretty well, and that might be of academic interest, but it doesn't necessarily mean any kind of significant impacts to the bear population, and it's correctable next time around by reducing that quota if that's in fact necessary.
Yeah, so, I took a look. The DNR says the for the 2024 bear season, of hunters harvested 4,285 bears, and that's a rebound from the below average harvest of 2,922 bears taken during the fall before season.
Right. Does it say, though, what that 4,200 was relative to the quota that they had established?
I don't see that.
Well, it may very well. It was certainly higher than the year before, but that is a function of many different things. Better bear population, better weather conditions for the hunters, whatever. But
yeah.
Not anything of major concern, I don't believe.
Yeah, the success rate was 37%, and that's up from 24% last year, and 31% is the five-year average. So,
it was just a good year for bear hunting.
I guess it was. Lee, thank you for calling. Steve in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Just before the break, Professor Craven made the comment that the DNR is best equipped to be managing wolves. And I wanted to point out, and it's my understanding, that actually the reason a federal judge put the wolves back on the endangered species list is because the DNR mismanaged the hunt and there was a severe overkill. So I thought that point should be out there. And if I'm correct, or else Professor Craven comment on that, but to me, that was pure opinion when you said that. And actually, a federal judge protected wolves because of how the DNR didn't do their job.
Steve, thanks.
Well,
Scott, comment?
Thank you. Yeah, my comment is personally, as someone kind of on the outside looking in now, I'm tired of some of these populations being managed by the federal judge situation when it may be a federal judge 2,000 miles removed from Wisconsin who was just listening to a series of arguments, and they may never have seen a wolf before. But that notwithstanding, the hunt that was seemingly botched was forced upon the DNR by the legislative process before they were prepared to do a hunt, but needed some time to set up the permits and the timing and a variety of other things. But they were basically told, do it now and do it as best you can. And if it didn't work out that well, and if the assessment of the success of the hunt was based on the fact that the quota was exceeded, yeah, that was not what was desirable, but it was a one-time thing. And you know, end of story. If you go back to the previous hunts where the DNR had the time and the ability to manage the harvest, set the time for registration and other things that they needed to keep the quota in line, the quotas were almost spot on and met that way for 3 years. And then all of a sudden there was a rush job that didn't go well, but not necessarily because of DNR actions. Then all of a sudden, everybody's excited, and a judge somewhere, I have no idea what the judge's experience with wolves were or what they were told, but they went back on the endangered species list, and I think that was a mistake. And that's my, for better or for worse, that's my opinion, and nothing more than that.
Dean, Steve, thanks again. Dean in Northeast Iowa, we'll go to you. Hi, Dean.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Appreciate being on.
Sure.
In regards to the red-headed woodpeckers, I just recently moved to Northeast Iowa here, and well, not recently, but about 80 years ago, and I had the same experience, having remembered them when I was a child, 50 years ago or better, seeing lots of red-headed woodpeckers, and then, of course, we didn't, and they did have an issue. But now, in the area where I now live, one of the things I would ask the earlier caller, is what kind of habitat they were in, because they, I've got an area down here across from Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, called Effigy Mounds National Monument, and that has an extremely open, mature woodlands with understory is not there because of mature forests and stuff, and there are red-headed woodpeckers all over the place there. And so that's one of the things I would look at if they were, you know, wanting to check on, you know, the population, whether it's just, an accidental thing or, you know, what kind of habitat they're viewing them in. Because when I walk through the Effigy Mounds, for example, there are red-headed woodpeckers all over, and it's a very mature forest. So, as I said, little understory there. And then question or comment would be, and I came in late, so I don't know if Dr. Craven mentioned it, but I grew up along the Mississippi River in southeast Minnesota, southwest Wisconsin, and back in the 70s and 80s, there were rough grouse all over the place. And I agree it's a habitat thing, but I remember growing up when they did forestry or people come in and did logging over in this part of the world, the Driftless region, it looked like they just did a clear cut in some of this bluff country. And, of course, that created the early successional habitat, which was, you know, extremely important for the rough grouse. Well, now they don't do that sort of thing. It's more timber stand improvement, and they take a different approach to forestry. And then, of course, the aspen, which has been disappearing, isn't really worth anything in terms of a lumber product. So a couple other things going on there. And then my last comment, I still do hunt grouse in northern Minnesota, and last year's comments from the DNR there was that it was going to be a 50-year high in drumming counts, which was amazing. However, then we had water upon water upon water in terms of rain from May into late June, and a lot of destruction, I think. That's my personal opinion, because the grouse numbers where we generally hunt just weren't there. But it was extremely wet, and so that's another factor we don't have.
That makes sense. Scott, comments?
No, the caller's comments are spot on as far as the grouse situation, and I simply don't know about the red-headed woodpeckers, but if they're mounting a furious comeback in some areas, they're a spectacular bird, and I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you, Dean. Appreciate your call. Perry in Oconto, your turn. Hi, Perry.
Yes, I have two things. First, for the gentleman up in Marinette County, I'm in Oconto, I would suggest joining the Rough Grouse Society in Marinette County. They help do habitat restoration and lobbying for more clear cutting and stuff like that. But the thing I wanted to talk about, since it's 2025 and the start of a new year, I think everybody hopefully can kind of get behind closing this Line 5 with Enbridge trying to reroute it. I just looked it up on Pipeline and Gas Journal, and they had concerns about the company, and they're in the same industry, talking about Enbridge's rising cost of putting a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac, and probably right now they figure it's $750 million, and of course everything is cost overrun. They said that if there was a spill, Enbridge would not have the money to finance the cleanup. And, of course, if they build a pipeline, they're going to keep that thing open, and there's the declining demand, so their financial status will go down even further. So I just wanted to mention to people that if they can get behind the Bad River Tribe, the Wisconsin Sierra Club, and Greenfire, they're all trying to put a kibosh on some of this, and let's get out there and do what we can.
Scott, comment.
No. I don't know enough. I'm not informed enough about the Enbridge situation to know where that line's currently sited and what the status is, but
I will just say that his comment about joining the Rough Grouse Society is generically darn good advice for people who are interested in conservation and participating in various forms of outdoor recreation and want to give back a little bit, whether it's the Grouse Society, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, or on and on and on. These conservation organizations get you together with like-minded individuals and allow you to put a few bucks behind conservation when it's desperately needed. So get out there and join some of those groups and be a participant.
Yeah. I was amused to see these stories on carnivorous squirrels in California. As long as I've been doing the show, from time to time we'll have comments from people. A squirrel would grabbed a bird on the ground and ate it. What the heck's going on?
I read that was California ground squirrels they were talking about, and they were making a big issue out of the fact that they were preying on voles when they were abundant. And that didn't surprise me at all. And as you pointed out, Larry, we've had the reports on the radio over the years, and I've observed them myself with either our 13-line ground squirrels preying on nestling songbirds that were fluttering around on the ground or couldn't fly yet, and gray squirrels taking bird eggs and nestlings out of nests. It's not unheard of at all. So that report came as no big revelation.
There was a big deal made out of it, but I just didn't. I thought, well, this has been going on forever. On that note, Scott, we are out of time. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much. Thanks, Scott.
Be back in March.
Bye. All right, back in March. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, our guest here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.